Well, some of you will be pleased, others less so, that in a couple of weeks' time, the European Football Championship begins. And amongst other things, that's likely to mean, in the latter stages of the competition, penalty shootouts. And penalty shootouts are fascinating things. When taking a penalty, you're 12 yards from the goal, you're dead centre, there's only one man in between you and the goal. Any professional footballer ought to be able to score in those circumstances, but of course they don't all score. Quite often, skillful, well-respected players make a complete hash of it. Why? Well, it's not because they lack the ability to kick a ball with accuracy and power. It's because it's a pressurized situation and mentally they're not in the right place. Sometimes, indeed, as a spectator, you can see it before the penalty's even taken. As the player walks up to take his turn, by his posture and his facial expression, you can see that in his mind he's not ready for this. He's not in the zone. And I have a feeling that for many of us, we approach the Lord's Supper like it's a penalty shootout. And the key thing then is being in the zone. And perhaps often we've walked out of here after a communion service feeling like one of those footballers who has just missed a penalty, kicking ourselves because we weren't mentally in the right place. And as the bread and wine were served, we just weren't in the zone and we made a complete hash of remembering the death of Jesus, and now we've a whole month to wait until the next opportunity. And because we think of the Lord's Supper in those terms then, the question to which we gravitate on an occasion like this when we're considering the topic is, how can I observe the Lord's Supper better? How can I make sure that I'm in the zone? What exactly am I doing in those moments that the supper is taking place? But I think that's the wrong question. I think there's a far better and more appropriate question to ask, and it's this: what is Christ doing as we participate in the Lord's Supper? What is Christ doing? That's the question that I want to focus on, and I want to highlight five things that Christ does as we sup. First then, Christ comes. Christ comes. Do this in remembrance of me. It's like, fasten your seatbelts and prepare for takeoff. I say that line and immediately you all think aeroplane. And you have a mental picture of sitting there inside a huge tube with wings, waiting to hear the engines begin to roar. I say, do this in remembrance of me, and immediately you all think Lord's Supper. And you have a mental picture of sitting in a hushed room and waiting for that loaf of bread to be passed to you. They're just iconic, evocative words that lie right at the heart of this event. No Christian can ever say, do this in remembrance of me. Now, where have I heard that before? What's that about again? The phrase is indelibly associated with the Lord's Supper. But it's a phrase that we mustn't misconstrue. You see, we're familiar with memorial services, aren't we? A memorial service is an event held in remembrance of someone. And you know what happens. Friends and family members will come to the front at a memorial service and speak fondly of the person. And these services vary. Some are very subdued, others less so. Some have a religious flavour, others don't. But memorial services all have one thing in common at least, and it's this: the person in whose remembrance the service is taking place isn't there. If the person were in a position to be there, the memorial service wouldn't be happening. Memorial services happen for dead people who, by definition, cannot attend. When we hold the Lord's Supper in remembrance of Christ, it's not like that. It's not that kind of memorial service. It's completely different, because in this case, the person in whose remembrance the service is taking place actually attends. It's not just the rememberers who gather, it's the one being remembered. Not just Christians, Christ. He's there. He's present as we sup. Christ comes. This term, the Lord's Supper, is of course a biblical one. It occurs there in our passage this evening, 1 Corinthians 11, verse 20. And in the Greek text, it's a very interesting term. In Greek, you don't get apostrophe S like you do in English. So, Lord, apostrophe S, supper. You don't get that in Greek. And what, as a Greek reader, you would expect to find in verse 20, therefore, is the phrase, the supper of the Lord. That's what you would expect. That's a normal Greek way of putting things. We have that kind of phrase in verse 26, where we have the Lord's death in our English versions. It's the death of the Lord. That's the phrase we have. And you'd expect then in verse 20 it to say the supper of the Lord. But that's not what Paul writes. Instead, alongside the word supper, he uses an adjective that's only used one other time in the New Testament. And the adjective means belonging to the Lord. So, the belonging to the Lord's Supper. That is what Paul writes here. Why? Why does he use that very explicit, very unmistakable, very strong, very unusual word? Well, in my mid-teens, I spent many Saturday afternoons at Bootham Crescent, at that time the home ground of York City Football Club. I'd be there always more or less in the same spot, standing on the terraces in the David Longhurst stand. David Longhurst was a York City player who, during a match at Bootham Crescent in 1990, suffered a heart attack and died on the pitch. And that stand then was the David Longhurst stand in the sense that it was subsequently named after him. It was a tribute to him. It preserved his memory. And that was the extent then of his connection with that stand. It wasn't his stand. He didn't preside over it in some way, opening the turnstile for you on a Saturday afternoon and showing you to your place and enjoying the match with you. No, it was merely named after him. And I think Paul is concerned here that the phrase, the supper of the Lord, is too vague. That could suggest this supper is like that stand at Bootham Crescent. It's merely named after the Lord Jesus. It's a tribute to him. It preserves his memory. No, Paul says. As he uses here this strong word, Paul says, no, this is his supper. He presides over it. He is the host. This is a further dimension to Christ's presence at our gatherings. I talked last time about that chap I used to know. I said it was when I used to preach at the church in Livingston. I remembered afterwards it was actually a church in Bathgate, but they're quite close anyway. And in this church in Bathgate, it was a small congregation, and this fellow, he did everything. He kind of led the service. He made the teas and coffees afterwards. He played the hymns. He sort of played the piano during the hymns. He did everything. And I said then that Christ is a bit like that at our services. He's both the preacher, I said, and the presenter, to use a Highland Presbyterian term. By the way, one always thinks of the best things to say after one has preached and finds the best quotes to use after one has preached. And after last time's sermon, I found Calvin saying something very similar. Christ is the chief conductor of our hymns, Calvin wrote. Well, here's another thing now that Christ does in our services. Having presented or conducted as we sing, and having preached as we sit listening to the sermon, Christ is then also our host as we partake of the bread and wine. This is why, you see, Paul can make this extraordinary statement here in verse 20. When you come together, it is not the Lord's Supper that you eat. That's extraordinary, isn't it? What does he mean there? Why wasn't it the Lord's Supper that the Corinthians were eating at their gatherings? Are they omitting the bread? No reason to think so. Are they omitting the wine? No reason to think so. Are they omitting the focus on Jesus' death? No reason to think so. As far as we know, they were ticking all of those boxes. If the Lord's Supper is the Lord's Supper in the same sense that the David Longhurst stand is the David Longhurst stand, then the Corinthians were eating the Lord's Supper. How then can Paul say what he says in verse 20? How were their meals not the Lord's Supper? Well, they were not the Lord's Supper because the Lord was not there. Poorer members of this Corinthian church were being humiliated at these meals, verse 22. And Christ cannot endure a gathering where that kind of behavior is going on. And so he was staying away. He was failing to show up. And thus these occasions were not the Lord's Supper, because the key component at the Lord's Supper is not the bread and it's not the wine and it's not the words. It's the host. That's the key component. It's the host. It's the host. We really need to get this clear in our thinking. The Lord's Supper is not about you and I closing our eyes and putting in some intensive mental effort helped along by a couple of props, a couple of visual aids. No, the Lord's Supper is about a living encounter with Jesus Christ. I have a feeling we find it easier to grasp that in relation to preaching. But we must grasp it in relation to the Lord's Supper too. It's a living encounter with Jesus Christ. As we sup, Christ comes. Secondly, as we sup, Christ communicates. Christ communicates. This is what he does as he comes. He communicates. He communicates the gospel to us. His saving work on our behalf at Calvary's cross. He communicates that, and he does so through these vivid symbols. First of all, bread. Bread representing that physical body of Christ that was so integral to his sin-bearing sacrifice. Colossians 1, 21 and 22. You who once were alienated and hostile in mind, doing evil deeds, he has now reconciled in his body of flesh by his death. 1 Peter 2:24, he himself bore our sins in his body on the tree. So bread representing Jesus' body, and then wine. Wine, which most obviously represents Jesus' blood. This is my blood of the covenant, he said at that first Lord's Supper, which is poured out for many for the forgiveness of sins, Matthew 26:28. But wine, which as well as that, also, I think, expresses the joy that is ours as a consequence of Christ's sacrifice. Wine gladdens the heart, Psalm 104, verse 15. At the Lord's Supper, we taste this sweet, heart-lifting drink because we are those who have tasted God's sweet, heart-lifting salvation through the cross of Calvary. Both these meanings of the wine explain why we do use wine at the Lord's Supper, not some insipid watery substitute. As Doug Wilson puts it, the wine we use in communion should be like the gospel, that is potent. We do not want a grape juice gospel, but rather a gospel with a kick. The blood that the wine represents is potent blood, able to remove the deepest, dirtiest stains of sin. Grape juice offers a very inadequate picture of that. And the joy that the wine expresses is potent joy, the joy of complete, ultimate, irreversible forgiveness, the intensity of the sensation as proper, full-blooded wine makes contact with your tongue that vividly captures it. So I'm saying through the bread and wine, Christ, the host at this meal, communicates the gospel to us. And I want at this point to say something very important indeed. If that's correct, that at the Lord's Supper, Christ comes and communicates the gospel to us, the gospel, then 1 Corinthians 11, verses 27 to 32, must not be interpreted in a way that contradicts that. Far too often on the basis of those verses, the bar has been set very high for participating in the Lord's Supper. You have to be worthy. Only the worthy can take part. Now, do we make that a condition for participating in the gospel of Jesus Christ? You have to be worthy. Well, of course we don't. So if the gospel says, come just as you are, but then the Lord's Supper says, you have to be worthy, then The Lord's Supper doesn't communicate the gospel to us. It contradicts, it obscures, it clashes with the gospel. So what's going on here? Well, the problem is we've misapplied those verses of 1 Corinthians 11. We fail to appreciate this crucial distinction, that there is all the difference in the world between eating the Lord's Supper in an unworthy manner and eating the Lord's Supper as an unworthy person. Paul's problem is with the former, with eating the Lord's Supper in an unworthy manner. That's the language he uses in verse 27. His problem is with inappropriate behavior at the meal itself. In this case, as I said a moment ago, humiliating poorer members of the church at the Lord's Supper. So if then at NREC, one of the helpers was going around with the bread or the wine, and in the process of doing so got into an ugly brawl with somebody else in the room, then that would be us eating the Lord's Supper in an unworthy manner. Or if one of the helpers, while taking around the bread or the wine, kind of subtly put his hand into a lady's handbag and took her purse, that again would be eating the Lord's Supper in an unworthy manner, inappropriate behavior going on at the Lord's table. And Paul, as I say, he has a serious problem with that. But eating the Lord's Supper as an unworthy person, Paul has no problem with that. By definition, indeed, that is what we do. If we weren't unworthy persons, then we wouldn't need the gospel, would we? And we wouldn't need the bread and wine that communicate the gospel. The gospel and the Lord's Supper are for unworthy persons. No one has written more emphatically on this than the reformer John Calvin. He writes devastatingly about those who set the bar high for the Lord's Supper. Listen to what he says. He says, when they have intended to prepare persons for this worthy participation of the sacrament, they have dreadfully harassed and tortured miserable consciences. They have said that those eat worthily who are pure and cleansed from all sin, a doctrine which would exclude all the men who now live or ever have lived upon earth from the benefit of this sacrament. For if it be necessary for us to derive our worthiness from ourselves, we are undone. Nothing awaits us but ruin, confusion, and despair. Though we strive with all our powers, we shall gain nothing at last but a discovery that we are most unworthy. He continues, that we may not precipitate ourselves into this abyss, therefore, let us remember that this sacred banquet, talking about the Lord's Supper, this sacred banquet is medicine to the sick, comfort to the sinner, alms to the poor. The best and, this is lovely, the best and only worthiness that we can present to God is to offer him our vileness and unworthiness, that he may make us worthy. To despair in ourselves, that we may find consolation in him. To humble ourselves, that we may be exalted by him. To accuse ourselves, that we may be justified by him. And he concludes, surely it must betray extreme ignorance, not to say stupidity, to require in the reception of the sacrament that perfection which would render the sacrament unnecessary and useless. For it was not instituted for the perfect, but for the imperfect and feeble. So I'm saying in the Lord's Supper, Christ comes and communicates the gospel to us. And 1 Corinthians 11, 27 to 32 doesn't contradict that. It doesn't make the Lord's Supper less accessible to sinners than the gospel is. The gospel is for the unworthy, and the Lord's Supper too is for the unworthy. But just one more thing here before we move on, and we will then move with much more pace. And this is a bit similar to a question I asked this morning in relation to singing. Why do we need this communication of the gospel in the Lord's Supper when we have the communication of the gospel in the Word? The Bible and the preaching of the Bible communicate the gospel. Why do we need bread and wine? Well, in answer to that, I would say this. We don't take that approach when it comes to our close friendships and our marriages. In those relationships, we express our affection for one another verbally, but we don't then say, well, anything else beyond that is unnecessary. Verbal expressions are enough and require absolutely no supplements. No, we accompany our verbal expressions with other tangible demonstrations. We shake hands, we hug, we kiss. We reinforce the affectionate words that we speak. We communicate our feelings through these other media as well. And Christ is the same. Christ is the same. Samuel Rutherford once said, the evangel, that is the gospel, the evangel is Christ's love song. So when the gospel is preached to us, it's Christ singing his love to us. I love you. I love you. That's what Christ is saying as the gospel is preached to us. That's what he's saying through words in the preaching of the gospel. But that's not enough for him. He wants to express that love tangibly too, in ways that we can touch and taste and feel physically through this meal. The bread and the wine. I'm saying it's the equivalent of our hugs and kisses. It's Christ reinforcing his I love you. Really, my friends, he's saying in the bread and the wine. Really, my friends at NREC. Really, I love you. What a thing that is. So as we sup then, Christ comes. As we sup, Christ communicates. Thirdly, as we sup, Christ channels. Christ channels. As he comes and communicates the gospel to us, something happens so that we don't go away unchanged from the experience. Evangelical Christianity has spoken for centuries of the means of grace. That is not itself a biblical phrase, but the concept can certainly be inferred from the Bible. It's a basic assumption of the New Testament that believers belong to churches. The New Testament doesn't recognize the existence of churchless Christians. Christians belong to churches. The reason for that is that churches are the setting in which Christians grow. You think of a baby and a baby's tiny little hands. And those tiny little hands will grow as the days and the weeks and the months and the years go by. But of course, they will only grow within a certain setting that is in connection with the rest of the body. If they were severed from the body, then they would not grow. And every Christian is a body part. And he or she then will only grow in connection with the rest of the body. That is in the context of the local church. Why? Why is that so? What's so good about churches? Well, the answer is, it's in churches that these things take place. Preaching, prayer, fellowship, baptism, the Lord's Supper. And those are the means then by which Christians are nourished and strengthened and energized in order to grow. That is to say, Christ channels his grace, his maturing, refining, strengthening grace through those things that I've just mentioned. And he channels his grace then through the Lord's Supper. The Lord's Supper is a means of grace. I think that's the strong implication of that fascinating language that Paul uses in 1 Corinthians 11:29. He says there very solemnly, in connection with these Corinthians who, as I say, are misbehaving so grossly at the Lord's table, he says, anyone who eats and drinks without discerning the body, and I'll comment on that again in a couple of minutes, eats and drinks judgment on himself. And surely the force of that phrase is this, that what is supposed to be happening at the Lord's Supper is the eating and drinking of blessing on oneself. The eating and drinking of grace on oneself. That's what makes this such a shocking phrase. The idea of eating and drinking, not grace, not blessing, but eating and drinking instead, judgment on oneself. The Lord's Supper causes something to happen in our lives. It causes growth. It causes edification. It causes maturation and development in us. Let me put it as boldly as I can. You and I will have suffered in our Christian lives from this 14 or 15 month suspension of the Lord's Supper. We've missed out. We've missed out on the grace that Christ channels through this particular means. Our growth will have been stunted over these months. So let's resume the Lord's Supper, hungry for these real, actual benefits Christ bestows on his people as they sup. So as we sup, Christ comes, Christ communicates, Christ channels, fourthly, Christ connects. Christ connects. And the Lord's Supper is emphatically a corporate event. We participate in this shared meal. We don't say, well, look, we're providing some bread and wine, but if bread and wine isn't your thing, then just bring along some other kind of food and drink and you can join in with that. No, it's a shared meal. And as we participate then in this shared meal, Christ connects us more closely to one another. That's what Paul says in the previous chapter, which is the other main place in the whole of his writings where he deals with the Lord's Supper. There it's briefer, and I haven't focused on that passage. We focused on it not all that long ago when we were looking at 1 Corinthians 8 to 10. But just verse 17, Paul writes in the middle of that verse, "We who are many are one body, for," he says, "we all partake of the one bread." That's a very striking statement, isn't it? I'm not sure you and I would write that. We would probably write, "We who are many are one body, for at conversion, Christ united us all together." And that's true. And you could go to other passages which make that kind of point. Chapter 12, verse 13, Paul says, "In one spirit, we were all baptized into one body and were made to drink of one spirit." But here in verse 17 of chapter 10, he says we are one body because we partake of one bread. As we partake of one bread, we are made into one body. That's what Paul is saying. And you say, well, it can't be both, surely. Either we became one body at conversion, or it happens through the Lord's Supper. Well, not necessarily an either or. Just as in Ephesians 3, 16 and 17, Paul can say, "I pray that out of his glorious riches he may strengthen you with power through his Spirit in your inner being, so that Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith." Hang on a minute, Paul. Surely Christ already dwells in our hearts through faith. That's what it means to be a Christian. Well, yes. But he's presumably saying there that as you're strengthened with power by the Spirit in your inner beings, Christ will dwell more deeply, more richly in your hearts. And similarly then, yes, we are objectively joined together, connected to one another through our conversions. But nonetheless, we are connected more closely to one another as we participate regularly in this shared meal. That's why it's such a tragic irony, you see, that there of all places, at the very Lord's table, this very place where Christ is connecting his people more closely together, there of all places, the Corinthians are being nasty to one another and humiliating one another. And that's what Paul is talking about then, I think, in verse 29, where he's of chapter 11 again now, where he says, "Anyone who eats and drinks without discerning the body eats and drinks judgment on himself." The body there is not now Christ's body in the sense of his physical flesh that was sacrificed on Calvary. His body now is the church. And the problem of these Corinthian believers is that they're not discerning the body, the church, their fellow saints, their brothers and sisters. They're not interested in their brothers and sisters as they partake of the Lord's Supper. And Paul is saying that's such an irony, because one of the very purposes of the Lord's Supper is that you should be connected more closely to your brothers and sisters. I think this connecting that takes place at the Lord's table may have relevance to what Paul writes in verse 26. It's interesting, isn't it, what he says in verse 26. As often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death. It's a bit like what we were saying this morning about singing, that in singing, we all become proclaimers to each other. It's not just the preacher now who's proclaiming. We're all proclaiming something to each other. And Paul says here then that in the Lord's Supper, you, plural, you believers, are proclaiming. And again then, like with singing, he seems to be saying that in the Lord's Supper, we are preaching the gospel to each other. Ultimately, of course, it's Christ who is preaching the gospel, as we've been saying through it. But that happens through us kind of proclaiming Christ's death to one another. Perhaps he has in mind just the passing of the bread and the wine to one another. And it's as if in passing the bread that symbolizes Christ's body and the wine that symbolizes Christ's blood to one another, we are in that very action saying, take the gospel afresh, brother. Take the gospel anew, sister. The Lord's Supper connects us more closely together. Again, Calvin speaks in a lovely way about this. He says it's like the interchange, the Lord's Supper he's talking about, it's like the interchange of a mutual pledge by which we reciprocally bind ourselves to all the duties of charity, that no one among us will do anything by which he may injure his brother or will omit anything by which he can assist him when necessity requires and opportunity admits. So as we sup, Christ comes. Christ communicates, Christ channels, Christ connects. And then one final thing, as we sup, Christ corrects. It's not now C-O-N-N, but C-O-R-R, Christ corrects. We've had several series over the last couple of years in 1 Corinthians, looking at different parts of this letter, and we've seen quite different topics being covered. But I think there's a thread that has run through all the sections of 1 Corinthians that we've considered, and it's this. Perhaps the greatest of all the Corinthians' problems was this sense they had of having received already the full package of salvation. So that was there when we looked at chapter 15. Why does Paul deal at such length with the future resurrection? Because the Corinthian believers aren't looking forward to the future resurrection. They don't think that's an issue. They don't think that's going to happen. They have no longings and expectations for it. They think they already have the full package. They don't need to look forward to resurrection. In chapters 12 to 14 that we looked at, remember, they're obsessed with this gift of speaking in tongues. And probably one of the reasons for that is they understood speaking in tongues to be the language of heaven, the language of the new order. And they were speaking it already. Or then chapters 1 to 4 that we looked at most recently. And remember Paul's biting comment in chapter 4, verse 8, already you have all you want. That sums up the Corinthians. That sums up, in a sense, the whole letter. Already you have all you want. There's no longing, no expectation. You think you've made it and arrived already. And perhaps then one motive behind this excessive eating and drinking that was going on at the Lord's table in Corinth is again this sense that they're already in the new age. And they feel then that they've already arrived in the days that were looked forward to by the prophets. You think of Isaiah 25, verse 6, on this mountain the Lord of hosts will make for all peoples a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wine, a rich food full of marrow, of aged wine well refined. And we could go to other similar Old Testament prophecies which look forward to a kind of banquet in the age to come. And perhaps the Corinthians thought they were now in the age to come, and in the age of banqueting. And so they were really going for it at the Lord's table, eating lots, drinking lots. And Paul corrects that then, doesn't he, in verse 26, where he says very pointedly, as often as you eat this bread and drink the cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes. In other words, far from being the heavenly banquet, the Lord's Supper is rather a temporary arrangement that is in place until the heavenly banquet arrives at the coming of Jesus. And in that connection, then, it's interesting that verses 22 and 34 both seem to indicate that the Lord's Supper wasn't meant to be a proper meal that actually satisfied your physical hunger. In verse 22, he says, do you not have houses to eat and drink in? And then verse 34, he says, if anyone is hungry, let him eat at home. So Paul doesn't seem to envisage the Lord's Supper as being that kind of meal that would satisfy your physical hunger. And perhaps then that very fact, the very fact that Christ has given this meal that is of such tiny proportions, just having a bit of bread and a bit of wine, perhaps that is in order to correct any exaggerated views that we may ever have of our present privileges. In case we, like the Corinthians, come to think of us having everything now, Christ has deliberately given a very small, miniature little meal to correct those tendencies, to make sure that we don't mistake the present for the future. It's as if he's saying to us, as we just sip a little bit of wine, eat a little bit of bread, it's as if he's saying to us, look, the real supper hasn't yet come. The real banquet isn't here yet. This is just the starters. This is just the appetizer. The real meal lies ahead. And perhaps then your life is going very well and very smoothly. Kind of the opposite of what I was talking about this morning. I was saying this morning that, you know, many of us may be struggling, and that can be reflected in our worship. We're allowed to bringing those downbeat notes into worship, just like the Psalms do. But perhaps you're not in that struggling situation tonight. Your life is going swimmingly. And perhaps you kind of feel a little bit like the Corinthians, that you have everything now, thank you very much. There's not a great deal of longing and expectation in you. Well, when next Sunday morning you get just that little bit of wine and that little bit of bread, that is Christ gently correcting you and saying to you, no, no, you don't have everything now. You're not there yet. The banquet still lies ahead. Just a pathetic little meal this morning, because the day has not yet arrived when I will properly host my people and when they will be lavish eating and drinking in the kingdom of heaven. It's what Christ himself was looking forward to, isn't it? I will not eat the fruit of the vine again until I eat it anew, or drink it anew in the kingdom of heaven. And that's what we should be looking forward to. And the very smallness of the proportions of the Lord's Supper should only sharpen our appetite for the banquet to come. May God bless us. Amen.